This is Punches and Popcorn and the Pork Chop Express, and we're talking to whoever's out there who's listening. We're a show where we dive our way through the best, the worst, the history, and the science behind martial arts movies faster than we can see. But don't worry, it's all in the reflexes. You're joining us tonight in our inaugural season, Once Upon a Time in the 80s. Now, I'm not saying we're going everywhere and watching everything, but I do know it's a pretty amazing decade we're in, and a podcast would have to be some kind of fool to think we're alone in the podcast universe. I'm your host, Michael Huntone, and with me as always is our genius, our resident genius, Jay Burton Bills.
I like it. You stole my quote, Mike, so I'm just going to say hello, everybody. I'm talking about one of my favorite movies. Matt is back. I'm very excited.
Yes, yes. Oh, so much joy and fun to get to tonight. And, of course, with us is our walking weapon, the professor, Dr. Dom Xiaoping Damore.
We're about to get a storm here in Buffalo, and we saw the storms in this movie, which is one of my favorite things. The three guys with the crazy powers. Let's talk about this movie. I love it. It's great.
Yes. And sneaking aboard the Pork Chop Express, maybe like a wild man, oops, spoiler alert, is our own magic man, the man, Matt Knotts.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I heard you guys were doing 80s movies, so I had to jump in. It's like summoning Beetlejuice. As soon as you say 80s, there's just a flash of neon lights, weird geometric shapes, and then I appear.
Oh, yeah. So this is, as I said, this is our first season. We're changing our format here a little bit in Punches of Popcorn, and we're focusing on the movies that are really near and dear to all of our hearts, the 80s movies. And the movie that we're covering tonight is one that is near and dear to our hearts and is from a director that is very near and dear to our hearts. We're talking about 1986's Once Upon a Time from China, John Carpenter's famous foray into the world of martial arts and his last studio film. So lots of great stuff to talk about in this amazing film. But before we dive into this 80s martial arts classic, we need to begin with the razor sharp brilliance of our genius who will help us cut into the world of this film with our own gospel, the gospel of the guillotine.
You got it, genius.
Genius.
I'm a genius.
He's geniusy.
Wile E. Coyote. Super genius.
Was it you, genius?
You little genius, you.
Being a genius certainly has its advantages.
All right, so I want to talk about the white savior trope in films. Big examples of this are, think about like Last Samurai, where Tom Cruise shows up and shows the samurai how to do it right. Even Avatar, where Jake Sully shows up and becomes the best avatar. The white man sort of just showing another culture how to do it right. I think Big Trouble in Little China, this is like a nice subversion of that. I mean, obviously, Kurt Russell's on the posters, but Wang Chi, his best friend, is arguably, and this is like talked about by the cast and the director himself, that he's sort of the lead, Wang Chi, Kurt Russell's friend, and also way better at martial arts than Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell's, let's call him Jack Burton from now on. Jack Burton is a mess, and that's what I love about it so much. And even John Carpenter said at one point, he described Burton as like an American fool in a world he doesn't understand. So he's not showing up in this other culture's territory and being like, I'm going to show you how to do it. I'm going to give you morality. I'm going to give you my whatever and win the day and become the best of you. No, he's an absolute mess. Like, there's no like almost character growth. He is consistent. And that's kind of why we love Jack Burton. But just think about like the other characters, Egg Shen. There's no like, I don't know how to say it, like pandering or like what you'd assume. Like earlier the same year that this came out, A Year of the Dragon came out, and that was really controversial because, you know, the Asian community was like, oh, this is not okay because, like, Mickey Rourke shows up in this Michael Cimino world, which is always a seedy world, whether, you know, whatever culture it's in. But, you know, they were pretty upset about that, and they were upset about this movie, too. But I think in hindsight, it has kind of grown in estimation in terms of, like, you know, maybe a subversion of the white savior because we get, again, Wang Shi, we get Egg Shen, we get oh, what's Eddie Lee? Like, he's also kind of in the movie a lot, that character. And just like, just normal dudes. We're in their culture. They're not like, obviously, you know, Lo Pan's a different bag entirely. Like, we definitely get into that kind of fantastical realm of a different culture. But there are like grounding characters. And I, you know, from, you know, the Asian community in Chinatown and stuff like that. So again, I'm a white man. So what do I know? But at the end of the day, I think this is kind of a nice subversion of the white savior. And, Kurt Russell leans into it amazingly, and Jack Burton's one of my favorite characters, but he's, even Kurt Russell says he's the, like, side character. He's the buddy. This is Wang Chi's movie. We're going after his girlfriend. That's the drive of the movie. So that is the gospel this week.
All right. Love it. Excellent stuff. And I'm sure a lot of things that we're probably going to get to. But before we venture into this conversation, I need to make sure we're all ready. Guys, have you all taken your drink from the Six Demon bag this morning?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Feeling good.
All right. Well, let's toast this off and get started. Here's to the Army and Navy and the battles they've won. Here's to America's colors that... The colors that never run. Jay, you want to finish it off?
Something about let the feathers never fall off the great thing.
Yeah, close enough.
Thank you. You'll never lose a feather.
Let's go. There was no prep for these guys for me to start that. So we are recording this at an unusual early hour this morning. So by Six Demon bag, we mean like six cups of coffee for some of us.
You know, Mike, a text would have been fine. You could have just like, just say the line.
Just wait. You guys have seen this enough. You can fill it in probably, right?
I was close. I was like 40%.
You were there.
May the bird never molt too much.
This is the punches and popcorn version. So, yes. All right. We are into Big Trouble in Little China by John Carpenter, starring Kurt Russell. I don't think John Carpenter really needs an introduction here. We talked about, if you hadn't heard, go back and listen to our 2023 year in review, where I raved about the most exciting thing to happen to me in 2023 was thanks to my buddy Dom Xiaoping here. I got to meet John Carpenter at New York Comic Con, which was amazing. And again, I'm sure I don't need a lot of introduction here. Again, his
phone. I would like to describe that story while we're here.
Yes, please.
So we're setting up. For those of you who haven't heard the other ones, my wife has her own art business studio. My wife, So anyway, she's got her own business. She has her own art business, and we sell our stuff at New York City Comic Con. So we got there the day before the con starts, and we were setting up. And not too far from us is the John Carpenter. I wouldn't call it a booth. I would call it a stage because there's lots of stuff. So we're setting up, and and we look over, and we see a man who is he's an older man. He's got long gray hair and a ponytail, and he's wearing an entirely black sweatshirt and sweatpants from head to toe, and pristine white shoes. And we look over and we're like, "Wait, that's John Carpenter." And I go, and I know Mike is a huge John Carpenter fan. I'm like, "Go say hello. He's right over there." And he's like, "No." And I basically booted him over there to say hello. And Mike, do you want to pick this up from here?
Yeah, so we shuffled over. I will say I saw someone else go up to him. So I'm like, okay, I won't be the only person bothering him here during setup. And yeah, we introduced ourselves, and he was very gracious and kind and friendly with us. And even I was wearing like a ratty old Wu-Tang shirt, and he was nice enough to ask me about, "Oh, Wu-Tang, you like Wu-Tang, eh?" And of course, all I could mutter was like, "Yes." And I think I muttered something along the lines of like, "I love The Thing and Halloween, and I watch them all the time." And it was like, really, the discourse in my mind on loop was, "Don't sound stupid, don't sound stupid, don't sound stupid." It just got enough to then bravely ask, like, would you mind giving us a selfie? So Dom and I got our pictures. We posted that on our social media. I think right now it's at least me with him as our header. Yeah, so we got to, and then, you know, we tried not to keep it too long, and, you know, we got our pictures, and then we're like, thanks, walked away. And yeah.
I think what Matt said something to you in our chat, he said, like, you're kind of like coworkers that day. So it was, you were peers at that point. So that was kind of an interesting leveling, which I never considered. So I love that, because he's like, yeah, I'm at work and I'm talking, you know, to a coworker. I think that's pretty cool.
Just talking shop, setting up at the Comic-Con.
Talking shop. That's what you said. Yes.
Yeah. He was larger than life. Also, like, he's very tall, but also, like, he was very gracious and very nice. And he talked to us. Super. And, like, you know, you hear all these stories about celebrities not having time for you. And he was busy. But he took his time to talk to some of his fans, and I respect that a lot. So, like, I've always loved him as a director, but as a man, he seems like a really awesome guy. Like, it was a great experience. So, John Carpenter, you are a quality human being. Not that you need our approval, but, I mean, just, it was awesome.
It's so validating to hear that the guy that's behind so many of our favorite movies is actually just a super cool dude, too.
And just if you didn't know, the reason he was there is he, I believe, co-owns a comic book label, Storm King Comics. So,
of course he does.
They do a lot of stuff with his work, and they had a lot of things. Like, they had vinyls of his, like, soundtracks and stuff, but he's done, like, albums, too, which one of the cool things about John Carpenter, maybe is something we'll talk about here, too, is he generally does all the scores for his movies. So they had all that stuff. But definitely, if you're a comic book fan like we are, check out Storm King Comics. Yeah, great guy. And again, this is an incredible film. So this came out in 1986. It's starring his, what I think is John Carpenter's best leading man, Kurt Russell, who is maybe my favorite leading man. But that's enough of me. Guys, let's just, before we dive into walking through the movie, I want to hear kind of your raw thoughts about what this movie means to you.
Well, if I may, I'd like to springboard off of what Jay said. So, if what was interesting about the white savior thing, I thought the same thing, so I'm not going to retread what he said, but I find that this movie is, I wonder if it's a movie made for white audiences, but is trying not to do the white savior trope. Because, like, I mean, you got Jack Burton, and you have, what's her name? Grace? The green eyes, the two white people, Kim Cattrall. Yeah, and you're kind of following their story. So in a way, it's made for the white American. But like Jay said, it's not like glorifying that. It's almost like you're put in the shoes of someone who is in this different culture. And I often wonder, is that something that John Carpenter felt he needed to do in order to get the movie made? Because I was thinking, I'm like, you don't need Jack Burton in this movie. This movie could be entirely about Chinese people and people of Chinese descent in Chinatown, and all this stuff goes down. And I'm wondering, like, back then in the studio, they're like, no, man, you gotta have a white lead. Like, no one's gonna see this movie or make it otherwise. Yeah, we're not gonna make it otherwise. Some sort of bottom line studio bullshit caused that. I mean, it's not a criticism of the movie. I like how it came out, but I often wonder how much Hollywood and how much the forces that be in Hollywood kind of pushed upon him and are like, well, if you're going to make a movie in Chinatown, it can't just be with Chinese people. And you know what I mean?
It feels like in order to get that green light, he needed to throw in some white folk so we could... the North American audience could be like, oh, okay, I'll go to the theater to see this. Not that they did. This was a notorious bomb, but still, the attempt was made.
But as far as my thoughts on this movie, this movie's wild. Because what I like is, it's very much a mixed bag, because you definitely have, this kind of outlandish street crime. Mm-hmm. You have warring ancient societies. You have kung fu martial arts action with like a whole array of crazy weapons. Like, I love the weapons they use. Like, they use every weapon. It's almost like he just went to a surplus store and was like, okay, I need a cleaver. I need a sword. I need, like, let's get up. These two things look like back scratchers. We'll use these. I don't even know what this thing. Yeah, spinning things and like a blade with other blades and like all these kinds of crazy weapons. And there's a Yeti, there's some sort of like moray eel monster that comes out and eats a guy, there's a flying eye monster, there's like gods and demons, and like he's just like, I feel like it's a little unhinged, and I have zero problem with it, but it's just like, why is the Yeti there? Like, why not? There's a Yeti in it. Like, what the
Dom, when did you see this for the first time? Were you a kid or was it like
teenage? No. I saw this in graduate school, actually.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So a little history for y'all. Back in the day, for you kids, Netflix wasn't a streaming service. You had to order the DVDs, and they sent you
them. Which is
that
now. You can't order a DVD from Netflix.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they sent you them to your house. And so, because I was in grad school, I wasn't married, I didn't have kids, and it's grad school, so... your time. You have an interesting amount of free time. Let's just put it that way. Not a lot, not a little. It's just this weird kind of thing. Yeah. And so in my youth, so I used to just have a constant rotating, you know, cycle of DVDs from Netflix. And it was great. And I looked up, I'm like, Big Trouble in Little China. I never saw this movie. Let's throw it on there. And I watched it. And I was like, this movie's wild. I love it. And then the next time I saw it was last night.
Wow, yeah. Really? It's two times for you?
Yeah, that's it.
Holy moly.
It wasn't a childhood movie for me. It just kind of slipped under the radar. I don't know why.
I love that perspective.
Yes, yes. Jay and Matt, how about you guys?
So I think the first time I saw this, I was maybe 9 years old. It is the perfect movie for a nine-year-old.
Totally.
Kind of. I've talked about on the show before how like we watched the Kung Fu Theater on USA Network.
Yep. Yep.
Like religiously after WWF Superstars every Saturday morning. Then this movie came out and it was basically like, oh, hey, this is the distillation of all of those movies. You know, my 9-year-old brain using the word distillation, that didn't happen. but it's everything that I loved about all those movies. Also, it's the guy from the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes that's the good guy. This rules.
Yep.
And like the monsters, like. It's a funny thing because we were talking about it before we got on. Like, my kid is 8 going on 9. So he's about the age that I was when I saw this. I don't know if he'd be down with the monsters in this one, but I thought it was awesome. Because, I mean, we are of the generation where we all saw Large Marge at about that same age, right?
Oh, yes. right.
It's
which
true.
Which is the most nightmare fuel, I feel.
Oh, yeah.
So you get into this, and I had to look real quick because I was like, who did the monster work on this? So it's Richard Edlund and Screaming Mad George. So it's like names amongst names that worked on the effects in this, right? So it's like all of that coming together, plus, you know, every wild elemental kung fu movie that we ever saw, like wuxia style.
Yes.
But it's also, you know, like rock and roll with a dude with a mullet and a tank top all at the same time.
Moccasin boots.
And moccasin boots. Who I didn't realize until probably my viewing when I was the same age that Dom saw it for the first time. Like, oh shit, he's just doing John Wayne.
Yes.
Right.
Totally. Yes, he is.
100%.
It's just a bad John Wayne impression. And he is. Because I never realized how useless Jack Burton was when I was a kid.
Right.
I know, right?
Now you watch it.
And you watch it as an adult, and you're like, my God, he is literally the last person I want there at any given moment.
No, he's a goofball.
Oh, he's so useless, but cocky as any. And that's the thing I love the most. He is that classic, like, you know, the stereotype of the ugly American just stumbling in, and I'm the best at everything, and just fucks up everything he touches.
Right. And he's actually the worst.
He's miserable. The only time he's good is when he's dressed in the suit and tie. Like, that is the perfect when he's the salesman during the whole used car situation.
He
like,
hits a stride, then, yeah.
He nails it. Other than that, he's useless.
It's Inspector Gadget syndrome. Remember when you were kids? You ever watch Inspector Gadget?
Oh, yeah.
Inspector Gadget never actually does anything positive. He just F's up, and his niece and the talking dog...
Yeah.
Penny,
that's right.
Brain.
Yeah,
they saved the day every time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of 80s media that had that dynamic where the hero wasn't actually the hero. It was the sidekicks who were the hero, and the hero is actually the comic relief.
Right. Well, that was something in the, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but this film has one of the best commentaries I've ever heard. And thanks to Matt and Jay for both of you pointed out, like, oh, you've got to listen to this on the disc.
So
and
good.
We'll talk about physical media later. But there's a commentary that's John and Kurt Russell that I believe is recorded. And if I had to time it right, it was around like 2000. So it's kind of funny.
That's when
right
DVDs
when DVDs
were
came
hot.
Out, I feel like. Because nobody really knew what to do with commentary tracks. But I don't want to get too far in there. I want to make sure Jay gets in because I'm dying to hear what he thought.
Yeah, this was absolutely elemental in terms of my movie obsession. I think I just like randomly caught it on TV. Like, I think it was on AMC, and I was right around your age, Matt, like 8 or 9. And it's one of those movies when you're a kid, it rewires you as far as I'm concerned. Like, it's a gateway movie in terms of like, oh, I absolutely am obsessed with like Asian cinema and I need to check that out more. All the weirdness. Also, the big thing for me was the genre hopping. I just know that like a lot of people I know in my life struggle with A movie that's not just a drama. A movie that's not just a comedy. This movie is like 14 movies packed into one. I adore it. And I think, like, think about like Edgar Wright movies. Like, this absolutely is something that you can tell like Edgar Wright loves, because like the fight between Egg Shen and Lo Pan, where they like their rings shoot glowing samurai. Oh, that is something that's right in the fight of Scott Pilgrim with the Takanashi twins versus Scott Pilgrim's band.
Like, I never really thought about that. I never connected that, Jay.
It infused, you know, not only me, but like the filmmakers I love now. I mean, I could get welled up with tears thinking about how important this movie was to my development. There's just like a handful of movies I remember watching on TV when I was a kid that not only like made my love of movies, but made me. This is one of them. Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. There's a few others. This 1986 movie House, which messed me up when I was too young to see it. So anyways, long story short, this is like a seminal movie for me, and I just love it, and I'm so happy we get to talk about it today.
Well, I'll keep my history with it brief, because we've had a lot of discussion with this, and Jay wants to do a like big psychological dive with me into this.
Oh,
so
I do.
I don't remember really seeing this when I was a kid, and I had this thought that I was like, I don't feel like we watched a lot of Kurt Russell movies when I was a kid, because for some reason I thought my dad hated Kurt Russell. And so we watched a lot of action movies, but I was like, yeah, I don't remember watching this. And I was talking to the guys through our like Slack or text or something, and Jay was like, you got to find out why. Yeah. What doesn't he like about Kurt Russell? And I think I thought it was because in this era, like, Kurt Russell is kind of a pretty boy, which, as we've talked about and we'll talk about more, they really use that in this. And my dad, if you ever met my dad, I fondly describe my dad as he is a Raiders fan, and he is exactly what you would imagine a Raiders fan from the 80s to be. If you've ever seen the movie Stone Cold, which I love, so he would fit right in that movie. So I always thought, you know, my dad generally was somebody who's like, he thought someone was a pretty boy, he hated
your dad is Lance Hendrickson from Stone Cold, is what you're saying.
And why am I picturing
pretty much
your dad has his favorite pair of going to church spiked shoulder pads?
Oh, pretty much.
I'm pretty sure the first time I met your dad, which was at your wedding, I believe, or maybe a little bit before that.
My dad probably had a mullet every day that I had.
That's amazing. We got to get him on the show, Mike.
He's my dad. I love him. Well, the interesting thing here is that I texted my dad. I was like, Dad, I was like, do you like Kurt Russell? And he's like, yeah, I love him. He's one of my favorite actors. I'm like, what? And I'm like, do you like Big Trouble in Little China? And he's like, yeah, I love it. I have the movie. You're actually borrowing it from me. And I looked on my shelf, and I have the DVD on my shelf that I borrowed from him. So there's something like mentally going on there in my
That's
brain.
That's what makes it interesting to me, Mike, is why do you think this? Like, this is something you've inceptioned your own mind with this fact, and I need to know why.
I don't know, but
kids, don't do drugs. Don't do drugs. Say no to drugs. Dare to say no.
Were you just like, my dad doesn't even like Kurt Russell. I don't have to return this movie ever.
Right. Why would he want this
back? I don't know. Yeah.
He's been dying to watch it for 3 years.
Once I finally watched it, I freaking loved this for all the reasons that you guys said. It's so funny. That commentary I was talking about, Kurt, I forget if it was Kurt or John, but one of them described the movie as, this is a movie about a sidekick that thinks he's a hero and a hero that thinks he's a sidekick. Right. And that's just the best way to watch this. And again, just taking, you know, I grew up in the 80s. And so when this movie came out, myself, I think pretty much all of us were around like 6 years. So we were pretty young, and we kind of grew up after this, you know, Kurt Russell in late 80s, early 90s, really had his swing in like the action star. So that's part of it in my mind, like Kurt Russell is the star. And so it's fun to go back to this and see him, like, he thinks he's a star, but as we'll discuss, he does very little of note in this movie till the very end, even though he really tries. It's just charming. Yeah. It's great. That's my one regret, and maybe it's better this way, that if I had had my wits about me with talking to John Carpenter, I was like, oh, I wish I had brought up this movie. And then what came from, John Carpenter said he's a huge fan of the old kung fu movies. Like, I would have really loved to know, like, hey, what are some of your favorites? What did you love? You know, what were some of the influences here? That would have been cool to know. But all right, let's jump into Big Trouble in Little China. Let's walk through this movie. So our movie begins with a little intro that it's just a fun side note. I read that, who's it, Victor Wong, who plays Egg Shen.
Yep.
they added that scene in after the movie was finished because Victor Wong felt they had to reinforce that Jack Burton is actually a hero. Because when he watched the movie, he's like, oh, this guy isn't very good.
Yeah, probably a studio nut.
Right. They're all just laughing. He's like, yeah, that's the point. So we get that little intro that kind of sets the table for us. And then we meet Jack Burton on the Pork Chop Express. We're introduced to Jack and his friend, Wang Chi, played by the great Dennis Dunn. What is the bet that they play Pai Gao, I think, right? And
this movie's a little exposition heavy. Yeah. I feel like this part is just like they're old friends, yeah, and right. He loses his bet and owes him money. That's, yeah, setting the table. And what is the thing he says? He tries to chop a bottle in half? Like, what is the objective, to chop it in half? Because I feel like one of two things is going to happen when you hit a bottle with a machete. It's either going to not break, which is what happened, or it's going to shatter into a million pieces. Like,
that's what he was hoping.
Was
it's
he hoping
he
can cut that it in half, bet. Like, clean?
Yeah, exactly. So
I'm not sure.
The exposition here is twofold, right? So you've got Jack Burton in his truck running his mouth to probably no one, talking about how great he is.
Right. I was going to ask you guys who's he talking to? No one responds to him.
Kind of like we're doing.
He is the first podcaster.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, my wife was watching this, and she's like, I'm sure truck drivers have some crazy podcasts.
Yeah, if you jump on the CD,
or at least if they don't,
listen,
they should.
It's going to be fantastic. And he's eating the largest Italian assorted hoagie I've ever seen in my life.
Yes! It takes him a few minutes to get through that thing.
While driving a semi, so that gives you a lot of insight into who Jack Burton is. And then you cut to him and Wang, like, sitting there BSing, playing games, and then Wang goes to chop it in half. It doesn't work, and then you get the awesome Jack Burton. It's all in the reflexes where he pops up and catches the bottle as it's about to smash him in the face.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it sets the table. To me, it sets the table as Jack Burton is the biggest badass that's ever lived.
Right.
And I can't wait to see what happens next.
And what happens next.
It sets up everything for these cool little subversions that happen later.
Right, exactly. So they go, so they have to go to the airport to pick up Wang Chi's girlfriend. And there they run into the femme fatale is probably not the right word here, but Jack's nominal love interest, Gracie Law, played by the great and very young Kim Cattrall. I think this was her first.
I love when she enters and she'll actually announce her name. It's me. It's Gracie Law. Like, I don't know why that's charming, but it knocked me out. She says it a couple times and I love it.
Yeah, it's funny seeing her in this. My wife is a huge Sex and the City fan, so it was fun to see a really young Kim Cattrall on here.
She was in a lot of movies in the 80s.
Yeah, I was surprised. I forgot it was her. So I didn't watch Sex and the City.
Say that proudly.
I've never seen an episode. I hear it's a good show. Like, how can I put this? I hear it's a good show, but it's not a show made for marketed for a person like me. This, it's not a criticism. It's just, it is. Anyway, so I never saw her in that. When I watched, this for the first time, I'm like, I think that's the woman from Sex and the City. And I realized that, like, and then I watched it again. I'm like, oh yeah, it's the woman from the Sex and the City. And my wife, she saw it. She's like, oh yeah, yeah. What's funny is there's another movie that no one realizes she's in. She is in the sixth Star Trek movie. She plays a Vulcan.
Yeah.
And no one remembers her from that. Oh yeah. Oh, and she is. And I watched it recently. It's the Undiscovered Country, which, by the way, is one of the best Star Trek movies.
Oh yeah.
And she is superb.
She had a moment in the 80s. She was in things, Mannequin and Police Academy. Like, she definitely, before she went the TV route, she was almost a movie star.
Yeah, I think she's got a range. I'm very impressed with her work, and I haven't seen her she's most known for. So
we're at the airport, and the great thing about the airport scene is that gets our first fight, where we first get to see Jack Burton in action. Mm-hmm. And guys, how does Jack do in his first battle?
I mean, he's about as useful as a marzipan dildo in this fight. he really gets the job done if the job is not helping at all.
Did they set up his goofiness with the knife in this, like, where he's
but
sort
being
of
tasty.
Crappy at having knife play? Like, he drops it and then he gets knocked out.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he goes to grab it out of his boot, right?
Yeah.
Or is that later?
No, this is going to happen.
Yeah, you know what? You know what's interesting? I find this movie to be very complex in its own way, because there are actually three group. There's the two warring factions. One is the evil one. One is the good one. And there's another group of human traffickers, right? Yes. And this is that group, right? Isn't this like they go to the airport to kidnap people to put
they
in
should
the
tell
brothel
the ladies
to,
worth...
to
no,
sell
you're right.
into sex no. slavery?
Wear sunglasses so we cannot see your green eyes so you can just pass through clearly. It's
there are so it's essentially like the two supernatural factions, and then essentially I think they call them the triads, is that right?
Yep,
if I remember. And they're
tongs,
thank you. And they are the kind of awesome 80s punk rock looking dudes,
so good, great sunglasses,
who are kidnapping random Asian women at the airport and selling them into sex slavery. Can we just, like, why are we making light of
things
this?
Going on in this because, no.
I don't know. That's the worst thing. I would rather fight demons than the idea that normal women are being kidnapped and being sold to brothels. That's so fucked up. I'm just saying it. I'm just saying it.
It's
like,
1986. Well, so nobody cares. Yeah. 1986.
This was on 2020 in 1986.
Yeah, no one cared. Clearly no one cared. Like,
now the whole movie would have been the scene in the airport terminal.
Well, and it's funny. So one of the things about this movie that catches me watching it, and even just as the host of this show, trying to figure out how I'm going to, like, jot down an outline for us to go through this. Like, there is a lot going on in this movie. And the action in this, you know, John keeps this moving so quick. It's boom, boom. So we have this airport scene that immediately cuts into where we find all the we discover all the rest of the factions. This alley fight that Jack Burton and Wang stumble into because Wang's girlfriend, who wasn't even the target of the kidnapping, she gets taken, so they chase them and stumble into a tong war, which is funny. I heard in the commentary, Kurt was saying that John told him he had to learn how to drive a semi for the role. And it seemed from the conversation whether that, like, John was serious about that or not, and that Kurt might have put himself through that. It almost seemed like John might have been joking about it. But they point, if you watch it, he drives really badly into the alley. And that was Kurt's best attempt at driving him
in. I like to think that's just how Jack Burton drove.
Of course. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, of course.
I think that is so central to that character, where everything he does is about as half-assed as it could be.
Right. So they half-ass stumble into this gigantic gang war. And this is where we are first introduced to the true villains of this story, the Three Storms. And Lopez.
I want to ask you, gentlemen, because we are a kung fu movie podcast, what did you think of the actual fighting in this movie? Like, it's 86, it's a Hollywood picture. Like, I think it's pretty decent. What do you guys think of that?
I would echo that, Jay. Decent.
Yeah.
It was solid. So if you want to dissect, it looks great. It's all the big stuff. Like, if you watch a typical kung fu movie, you're going to have punches and kicks and jumps and flings, and not everything is going to be the big move.
Yes.
In this, it's all big moves. The entire thing is big moves. It's always a roundhouse kick. It's always a jump kick. It's always a flying knee. Or it's always crazy weapons. It's not a long choreographed fight that we get with a like we get in a Bruce Lee movie or in a Jackie Chan movie. It's like, okay, big kick, cut to the next scene. Big punch, cut to the next scene. Big stab,
yes.
In the next scene. Yes. A bow staff that sprays out smoke. Okay, next scene. So I don't want to say that takes away from it, because it's very much, it's awesome. But it's not like, it's not the kind of thing you get where you have a movie focusing on a martial arts master.
Right.
It's,
yeah, they don't have like Jackie Chan like needing to show off his skills. And what I kind of like about it too is it kind of exhausts you, that type of fighting, before things turn supernatural. So I kind of like that. Like, let's do all the cool shit at once before we introduce, you know, like lightning powers and stuff like that. So
there is a martial arts movie trope. They use guns and then they just...
Yep.
Yeah.
Stop using guns.
They ran out of bullets.
And then they fight with weapons.
I mean,
like what happened? You run out? They just ran out of bullets, and they're like, oh, crap. And both sides ran out of bullets at the same time, and they're like,
in San Francisco, you're only allowed to have about 35 bullets per weapon in any shootout, and then you have to go to your kung fu skills.
That's true. This is the Democrats'
fault. It's a city ordinance.
Well said, Mike.
Them damn liberals. No, dude. So like, I find this funny. Like, it kind of ruined things for me that the first movie we covered was Enter the Dragon, because then right. Bruce Lee just says, "Why don't I just shoot them?" And I'm like, that line plays every single movie we've covered. I'm just like, yeah. Why don't they just shoot them? Why don't, thanks, Bruce. Like, and I'm watching this movie and I'm like, oh, they shoot them. Great. That makes sense.
This
and then
is
they
why
stop
all those
and I'm like,
Shaw movies took place when they did, because it was difficult, right. Nigh on impossible to have a firearm at that point. So you had to fight this way. You know, the best exactly. you could do is maybe throw something.
I mean, my opinion watching that scene was that it was showing you that ultimately the guns weren't effective, and it wasn't until they brought out martial combat weapons that truly the battle begun. And then once you introduce
the
God's
melee
superpowers, well, then what do guns matter when you've got a guy who's shooting lightning?
Exactly right.
Yeah, and you have Raiden 1, Raiden 2, and right, Raiden 3, right. And they're awesome. I love the friggin' storms. No, that's honestly, so like I said, I saw this movie in the mid-aughts, so I don't remember
I'm sure
a
there
lot of it.
There should have been.
There might have been beer involved.
There absolutely should be.
This, we're, like, let's put it this way. This was like, now I have a IPA or two while watching a movie. Maybe a scotch. That age, I would be like, hey, I'm going to do a power hour and watch this movie.
Way. I mean, I think this is a great movie to crack a Jenny Lighter since.
Yeah. Yeah, so like, I don't remember a lot of it, but like, I do remember so the great. Storms. And I'm like,
have those hats, are those at all, I don't know if anyone knows this, but like, is that just for the movie because it looks awesome? Or was that like was that hat functional at any point in history? I love those hats.
I listened to a couple of the commentaries and they talked about a few of the different costume things. That's not one I remember.
Yeah. Like
up.
if the answer is it looks cool, that almost makes me more happy because it looks cool.
Well, if any of our listeners know more about the history of the Three Storms hats, please share us.
Dom, you're right though. Those Three Storms, they're iconic. Honestly, they're so good.
Yeah. And just one thing I wanted to note about the martial arts here that I'm sure we'll talk more about. But as we said, John Carpenter was not a martial arts director. This is his first and I think only film, right, that he did in the martial arts genre.
Children of the Corn, Mike. There was a remake. Sorry. I'll
yeah,
shut up.
That's right. But he did look to bring in people that were really experienced. So his martial arts coordinator was James Liu. And he was the guy that in that airport scene that we talked about that fought with Jack Burton. He's the guy, so we got to see him there. Also, Carter Wong, who's Thunder, the big beefy guy that's just magnetic in this. He had a long history before this and after this in martial arts. These guys are all, like, serious credited in the martial arts film world. Dennis Dunn, who's our hero Wang Chi, mm-hmm. who actually does all the martial arts fighting for the good guys in this. He didn't have any martial arts movie experience before this, but in an interview I saw, he said he did grow up and trained in martial arts as a kid, so while it was his first time on screen, he had experience there.
He sells it well.
Yeah, John really wanted to make this work and true within the spectrum that they have. So we were introduced to the Three Thunders for the first, or the Three Storms for the first time. We get our first exposure to Lo Pan, and then Jack loses the love of his life, who will spend the most of the movie first and foremost trying to get back the Pork Chop Express, his car. So
yeah, it's funny. He's married to his truck, and Wang Chi is looking for his fiance. Yeah, and so like they're both searching. Like, they're both on a quest for their thing, which is another way of criticizing Jack Burton. His yeah. focus is his freaking truck, not a human life.
The mid-80s. Was
Americans
a huge
need their
point stuff. For movies about guys lusting for a truck. There was this and Over the Top right around then.
Semi-trucks had a moment, right?
Over the Top was all about a truck.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
They'd say in Over the Top, they're like, all right, Sylvester Stallone, you can lose your son, but I'll give you a truck. I'm like, that's the choice?
Yeah.
Don't forget.
Yeah, he's got to hang out with his son to get to the truck. That is over the top.
Truck or child. And it's a hard choice.
Oh, yeah, and the green-eyed fiance from China is played by Susie Pei. And she was a nude model. Wow. Don't ask me how I know this. It was simply professional research for this podcast, I swear.
Of course.
I think this is a good point for a break, guys. So let's find out how Dom knew that. And then let's also debate while we're offline here whether Over the Top is a martial arts movie. And we'll be back.
Hi there, this is Magnus of The Mind of Magnus, a show dedicated to help expanding the mind that I have in this big skull of mine. I've grown up with the love of factoids and curious about the world, so I'm taking the time to interview all the most amazing people I've met. So join me for The Mind of Magnus. You can find it at magnusapollo.com. And if you have a guest, you want to be a guest, you want to learn more about what's going on in this world, please join me here on the Lunchador Podcast Network.
And welcome back to Punches and Popcorn aboard the Pork Chop Express. We are driving through Once Upon a... Oh, man.
Once Upon a Time in the Big Trouble with Little China.
Big Trouble in Once Upon a Time in... crap.
Big Trouble.
Big Trouble in Little China. That's the movie we're covering. Big Showdown in Little Tokyo.
That's a different movie. Yeah. We'd do that one. That one's fun.
We have so much more of this movie. So we turn to Wang Chi's restaurant, Dragon of the Black Pool. That's such a cool name. I want one of those in Rochester. And that's where we get the exposition of kind of what's going on. We get Gracie comes back with her friend. And we learn a little bit about what's going on with the Three Storms and Lo Pan and who they are. And what I love is that while Wang Chi and his friends, family, right, are discussing all what happened, Jack is on the phone with the insurance company?
Yeah. Yes, a human has been kidnapped. He saw gods right. fighting, and he's like, but what about my pork chop?
White man be white man, yes.
But also, he serves as the exposition. He's not the exposition bot. He's the exposition, like, he gets the exposition because he's like, I'm not part of this culture. Please explain right, it to me like right, an, right. I'm an idiot, because I am. Also, can I point out, so that's an 80s trope, having the exposition, like, stapled in there. But also another 80s trope that I find interesting, no police.
Yeah.
In 80s movies, the police only, except for Die Hard, the police only show up at the very end, and no one ever calls them. No one ever calls them. You want to know what would happen if my fiance got kidnapped?
Well, they have that moment, right?
In the middle of an airport?
They call the fucking cops! Leave this to the police, and they hand wave that away, right? Like, the police won't, by the time the police deal with this, she'll be gone or something like that.
Eddie said that, right?
Eddie is underrated fun part of this movie. He's got a lot of really fun lines, and I like he's kind of the medium between Jack and Wang. The Wang is the guy in the know that does the fighting. Kurt knows absolutely nothing, and I like that Eddie is kind of like, he knows what's going on, not as effective as Wang, but he's not as, as clueless as Jack. So he's a fun in-between for the two. So again, we bring Gracie Liu back in.
Gracie Law. She always comes in like she's like Katherine Hepburn from one of the screwball comedies. It's always, she thinks she's in a Cary Grant and Katherine Hepburn movie.
Right.
Which is fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So we begin our first rescue attempt that is what we almost think is the heart of this movie, the story that, as our beloved professor here said, should probably be the most distressing part of this story for us, the sex slavery going on. And they attempt to break into the brothel to free Mao Yin. That's one of the first times that we get a really impressive, like, magical special effects martial arts sequence. That's also the part, Matt, you were raving about where we get Jack trying to be the hero by dressing as the straight man.
Yeah, he goes full on. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Used Cars. The Kurt Russell is in.
Yes, that he transforms into his Used Cars character. I thought the same thing. The glasses.
No, it's cool because, I really love Used Cars. It's a Robert Zemeckis movie. Good. It's the guys that wrote Back to the Future wrote Used Cars.
Right,
and it's
before
very funny.
Back to the Future.
Garrett Graham from Phantom of the Paradise is in it.
It's like an unsung 80s comedy.
I haven't seen it
more
in years. I remember it being really, really funny. It may not stand up.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Because I dug that in a big way.
It's so good. It holds up. Nice.
It's interesting in the commentary. Kurt often at one point talks about comparing like Zemeckis and Carpenter, like two directors that he appreciated and felt like they showed vision in their films. And he talked about Forrest Gump a little bit, which Kurt Russell, I think, is uncredited in Forrest Gump because he plays Elvis, right?
Kurt Russell is one of the top five Elvis impersonations I've ever heard in my entire life. He absolutely nails it. That's right.
Was in the John Carpenter TV movie Elvis as Elvis.
I didn't realize that was John Carpenter.
Their relationship is something I kind of always love when a director and an actor kind of have a connection. They absolutely do. I, at this point, I don't know if this is the commentary or an interview, but Kurt was like, he had had, you know, a couple bomb, like box office bombs around the time, and he was, you know, feeling down, and John came to him with this movie, and he was like, you know, I want you to be in this movie. And Kurt's like, you know, I've had some bombs. I don't want to tarnish this for you. And John's like, I just want to make the movie with my friend. Like, I well up when I think about that. Like, he's like, I kind of like hanging out with you. And if we can do that at work, just come be Jack Burton. And it's going to be fine. Don't worry about your box office credentials. And I found that very moving. Exactly right. He's not worried about, you know, box office. He's worried about, I just want to have a good time while we're
when you listen to that commentary, it's literally like these two dudes hanging out drinking beers. And it's so fun.
Yeah.
You can hear them cracking beers. It's beautiful.
It sounded like this must have been the most fun movie ever to make.
I think it shows in the film, too. Like, you can, it does. There's a certain amount of passion and joy you can see on the screen, and that's why. Everybody's having a good time making it, and it just turns into this giant cartoon. And I think this is kind of the part of the movie where it turns into the cartoon, right? Where he goes in as as the, I can't remember what name he goes by, but it's
right.
Oh, yeah. Completely ridiculous. Basically, yeah. Right. And the way he's always just adjusting his glasses and like, oh, he's
that Dorky McDorkson.
So good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does his best like horny Clark Kent. That's essentially Clark Kent in a brothel.
Yeah, I'm going to quickly like talk about this because that's something I just need to get out of my system. Like, I just need to praise Kurt Russell because, you know, think about like the macho 80s star. You know, like we talked about Stallone earlier with Over the Top, like Schwarzenegger. Like, they're not up for this. They're not going to play a character that's, you know, they wanted to be like the alpha male, the boss in the movie. Whereas Kurt is so comfortable being the goofball. Like, I read another interview where he made out with Kim Cattrall and she had lipstick on. And he talked to Carpenter after the scene and he's like, what about those movies? You're always making out with these women. Like, you'd have lipstick on your face after. And then they just put it in the movie. He has no problem being, you know, the brunt of the joke. And I think that's...
Absolutely.
I just need to praise this man because of all our, like, 80s testosterone guys, and I would include Kurt in that for, you know, various reasons. But he has no... There's no ego there. And I think it makes a huge difference. This is why I love Kurt Russell so much.
80s trope. Another one. People making out in the middle of perilous situations. Like, think of an 80s movie. Like I can't think of a time I would be less turned on than when I would be if I had my life in a life or death situation with ancient demons. And you know what? Like, he's like, well, I'm gonna make out with her right now. It's like, it happens all the time. It happens in Goonies. There's kids making out in a,
because it's children. Like, so I'll leave that be.
Underwater, like, you know, definitely 80s Trump.
But if you go back to, I mean, go back to the old like Errol Flynn and Tyrone Power.
I'll try one. Dom, it's our time down here.
That's why we're starting our season format in the 80s, because
I feel like they amped it
up
a little bit in the
80s.
Okay.
That's it. It takes all the tropes of everything from the 30, 40 years of film before it and then just throws an 8-ball of Coke at it, and that's why you get such great stuff.
Oh, yes. So after the brothel break-in, we get that is a failure, and failed rescues are a theme here. We get the next failed rescue attempt where the guys enter the Wing Kong Exchange, Lopan's front business, headquarters, and all that. And that's where we get the great line, I think, right before that. Isn't that when he says, keep the home fires burning, and if we aren't back by dawn, call the president.
Oh, yeah.
And they go in. What do they say outside?
Everything Jack Burton says. Is
Jack and Wang, they're like, all right, we got to time this perfectly.
Yes.
They're like entrances with their guises. What are they, like telephone repairmen?
Yeah, they're phone repairmen.
They just walk in like mumbling and run right through the back door.
They're repairmen.
Which in reality works like 90% of the time.
Yeah, I found that kind of believable. I was like, you know what? If a bunch of like doofy repairmen are just like, hey, security, we're just going to do our thing. And of course, keep in mind, it's the 80s. Right. So the security's like,
they get caught pretty quick. You know,
they seem harmless.
Yeah.
And they end up being harmless because they end up getting caught. And okay, I want to.
Oh yeah, well, that's where I'm going. Yeah.
This is the part where they meet. Yes, please. You get to really get to know David Lopin, played by the great James Hong. Can we talk about James Hong? I've seen him in a gazillion things, but this is his opus. I think he is great from start to finish in this. It's amazing.
For me, because I've seen it so many times and watched it with my kids, when I hear his voice, I think of Po's dad from Kung Fu Panda, which, again, he's great in. And I just, when he's talking, especially with all the makeup on, it's easy to just focus on the voice because the makeup is just crazy.
Oh, yes, right.
So one of the commentaries is with the special effects and makeup guy, Steve Johnson. And Dom, I don't know why we didn't think of this, and probably because we wouldn't have thought that makeup was cool in college. But Steve Johnson was saying when he was talking about getting into makeup, part of what prepared him for doing this is that when he was like a teenager, he would practice makeup on himself to age himself so that he could go buy beer. Because he's like, you know, you're talking about back in like the 60s. And he's like, yeah, if you just looked old, you could walk in there. So, and apparently it was pretty successful.
That's awesome.
So. Genius.
I had kids in junior high school that could grow beards and they bought beer all the time. So that still played right in the 90s.
Oh, yeah. So not that we're advising.
He has 456 IMDb credits, James Hong. The dude started in the 50s with the noir films, being unfortunately like a servant or something for it. But I mean, he's been in the industry forever and just always. And what I like too, especially, it makes endear me more to him in this movie is when he's at these autograph conventions. He says this is the 8x10 glossy he gets to sign the most is Lopin. Yeah.
And just kind of looking,
and he's really thrilled by that. He really appreciated this character because I think up to this point, this was like his most meaty role.
I feel like he's known well for Blade Runner as well, and we forgot.
Absolutely.
What movie he's in that we covered, and he plays a very similar character. He is in Ninja 3: The Domination. He plays the evil priest.
Oh yeah,
yeah, kind of a similar thing actually, and he hams it up, man. He's great. I love him.
You talking about the convention thing, that was something that I loved hearing. Larry Franco, the producer of this film, had said that this is the movie when he's doing movies now, like the younger people on set, like involved in movies, will come up to him and say, like, Big Trouble in Little China was like the movie for me. That's cool that it had this impact, which, as we mentioned, it kind of flopped. Part of that being that I think it came out the same weekend or close to as Aliens.
2 weeks later, Aliens came out.
And at the same time, it was fighting. This is why the 80s was nuts. It was fighting, you know,
we're lucky to get
box office wise, Top Gun, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And then 2 weeks later, Aliens come out. Like, what?
Right.
What
and the funny
was
thing was a lot
this
of the reoccurring
insane.
Theme I heard
all
about
these
what was going
movies
on behind
are just
the
like
scenes
jockeying for
was
like,
that the studio
you know, maybe
was aware that Eddie Murphy's The Golden Child was being made at the same time. And they're worried, like, we're going to have two like magical martial arts movies coming out at the same time. So they really apparently pushed that. I think was part of the reason John really soured on the studio system, because they pushed him like, we need this out quick. We have to beat The Golden Child out. And it's just funny now, like, I don't, who remembers The Golden Child?
You can't
Child?
Have two James
like,
Hong movies in the same summer. I mean, that's the thing. That's you're going to cannibalize the James Hong market. By the way, looking at box office totals from 1986, we've got Big Trouble in Little China, 29th most with 11 million. And Golden Child does
Holy
not make the
cow.
List. So
there you go.
People stayed home in droves for The Golden Child. It was a...
Really? An Eddie Murphy movie in the 80s?
Yeah, so the top three that year were Top Gun, Karate Kid 2, Back to School, Aliens. So top five. Aliens and Ferris Bueller were the top five.
Wow. Wait. Aliens was lower than Back to School?
Back to School beat it by about $6 million.
That's quite a list.
That's true. I mean, I love Back to School. Like, come on, Rodney. How can you not? It's just when you think of, like, Aliens.
People loved comedies back in the day. It's so good. Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I know. Because 80s comedies, like, I mean, I love them, and I think they're great, but I don't think they have the staying power. Like, I will show I feel like this generation can watch Aliens and be like, this movie kicks ass. But I feel like if this generation watches Back to School, they're going to be like, this is boomer humor, or they'll say something like that, or, you know, this kind of like, I feel like comedies are very much a product of their time. So like, that's why I think we think that way. You know, it's,
perfect example to fill out the top 10. There's Ruthless People. Mm-hmm. Does anybody remember Ruthless People?
It's very time sensitive. Right.
Legal
thing,
Eagles.
Yeah. What?
With who was even in Legal Eagles? I don't even remember.
Robert Redford, right?
And so it was a Redford movie. Cobra, the Stallone movie Cobra.
Oh yes.
Oh, Cobra. Let's cover that, please.
Poltergeist 2.
Okay.
And nice.
Number 10, Short Circuit.
Oh, oh my god, I love Short Circuit.
Johnny Five.
Yeah. So the sixth and seventh movies of 1986. So it's Top Gun, Karate Kid 2, Back to School, Aliens, Ferris Bueller, and then two movies nobody's seen in the last 40 years.
Right. Like what your parents went to
see.
Yeah,
I for sure had VHS. I might have the VHS tape sitting next to me in the basement right now of Legal Eagles and Ruthless People, because it was Robert Redford, Deborah Winger, Daryl Hannah, and Brian Dennehy. So that'll tell you exactly what that
that's
movie
a,
is.
Wow. Decent cast, though.
That's a huge cast.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're talking about Big Trouble in Little China.
So we meet Lo Pan, we get this great makeup, and then we get the great transformation scene with, like, the glowing lights that the makeup guy said, like, they built a mock-up of it that I didn't realize to listening to the commentary, a lot of this was all inspired by American Werewolf in London. Like, that transformation scene completely changed the game and how this type of stuff was shot. And so they used this idea that, like, the mannequin head that they shone the light through, waxworks. So they were joking. They're like, movies have been around forever, and Madame Tussauds has been around forever. And it wasn't until American Werewolf that people thought, like, oh, we could put the two together for special effects. So anyways, we get this really cool transformation scene. We get to see him transform from crippled old man, very reminiscent now, watching it now, of the awful old guy from Prometheus.
Oh, yeah. I gotta bring up Prometheus.
But he transforms into the... I try not to think about that movie. But he transforms into his more mystical self, which I read is what inspired the character of the Mandarin in Iron Man comics.
Really?
In the comics, Mandarin looks a lot like Lo Pan. So then we get their friends come to rescue them, and that
no, we can't. We don't have time.
Rescue their friends and escape. And so I love when. So this is our second escape scene, I think, or the first, maybe the first escape. And what I love is that. So when Jack and Wang get free, they come and find the girls and everyone else who's captured. And Gracie's other friend, the reporter, that's played by Kate Burton, Margot. Yeah, when you see them locked up, so Margot is in her cell, like, with a notepad and pen and chatting away and, like, writing the story. Gracie is hogtied and gagged.
Yes, right.
I just imagine, like, what she said to them in between, that they're like, oh, this one can just sit in here, but this one, we need to hogtie and gag in her cell.
It's when we learn that Sarah Jessica Parker has a time machine.
Yes, exactly. But they get them out, and they escape. We get this fun escape through the sewers. I like the scene when they're going through the sewers, and Kim Cattrall, Gracie, is like the first one up in the water, and she's like, where is Margot? And she pops up and, like, goes through all the characters, like, where's Wang and where is Eddie?
Yeah.
And, like, each of them, until it gets to Jack, and then talking about kissing in the middle of action, Jack gets her that. In a sewer, right?
That's great.
Right, but before
I'll put
they
Kim Cattrall in front of you
in a sewer, in a sewer. That's just that's totally the place I want to make out. Sorry. In a sewer.
Oh, well, I would too, honestly. Yeah,
I would kiss Kurt Russell anywhere. but they can't fully escape because Gracie gets kidnapped by the first creature that we see in this movie, right?
Yes,
the Wild Man.
Yeah, what? It's actually the Wild Man is, I think it's based on an actual, I kept saying the Yeti, but it's not a Yeti. It has a Yeti quality. Cause like a lot of cultures have this kind of ape man thingamajig going on, like a Wild Man or an ape man or something like that. And I know there's one, hold on. I think it's called a Yeren, which means Wild Man. And it's a big, it's basically the Asian version of a Bigfoot.
Right.
So they just chucked one in there.
100%. You know?
And that's another thing in the 80s. Crazy monsters that seem a little slimy or hairy. You notice that in like 80s movies? Everything seems a little mucusy and fuzzy and like icky. There's lots of like, yeah.
Practical effects were all the rage. Yeah. Let's goo it up.
And remind me, they don't really explain within the movie what this thing is or why he's there. He's just there, right?
Like, was there anything in the commentary, like, where this came from? Like, because it's just, even in this movie, it's out of left field.
It is. So, no, the only commentary that went on about this is, so the special effects and makeup guy, Steve Johnson, he spent a lot of time talking about this, and specifically about the stunt performer, because he was pissed. He said, so if you watch, he got really mad and kept pointing out, he's like, look at the feet, look at the feet. And they look all like floppy clown shoes. He's like, we built this so that it was supposed to look like Lon Chaney's Wolfman costume that was built so that Lon Chaney, if you watch the old Lon Chaney Wolfman, he walks around on his tippy, on his toes, so that it kind of looks like the reversed foot leg. Dom, you could tell us the actual name for this, of like a canine.
It's called digitigrade, where you walk on your toes. So it's a digitigrade walk. Yeah, no, like that's the way dogs walk. I understand. Yeah, dogs walk on the balls of their feet. Yeah.
So they built the whole costume with these big toes so that he would walk like that and could balance himself. And he didn't. He kept walking on flat feet. And he said when they were filming it, Steve kept going to this guy and he's like, you said you were going to walk on your toes. He's like, I didn't know that's what you're looking for. And he's like talking with him. He's like, no, on your toes, your toes. He's like, oh, I didn't know you meant your tippy toes. Okay, I can walk on my tippy toes. And then they do another take and he didn't do it. And he's like, they kept going up to him and they're like, no, you're supposed to walk on your toes. And he's like, okay, I got it. I'm going to do it this time. And he never did it. And they're like, finally, they just ran out of time. And they're like, John was like, all right, we're just going with what we had. And Steve, to like this day, as he's commenting on it, is pissed. Like, I know one of the questions the guy from Shout Factory that was doing the interview with him for the commentary asked him, you know, like towards the end of the movie, what would you, you know, looking back now, seeing the effects you use, is there anything you would have changed? And the one thing he said is, he's like, yeah, I would have gotten a stuntman who actually did what he said he was going to do, unlike this guy. So
that's so great.
So, yeah, I don't know that there's a lot of background, but he gets her, takes her, and the rest of the gang escapes.
Then they form a plan and come back.
Yeah, very Star Wars. They got away for the first time, so now they're going.
Yes.
Back. Yeah, so they go back. We get a little more exposition, and we're set up for the big showdown, the wedding, where this is all leading to. And the gang is now joined by one of those Tongs, right, that are apparently now good guys, helping them infiltrate Lopan's headquarters to go back and save the girls who, as we learn, are going to be married to Lopan because they both have green eyes. And
I was gonna say, we talked about why he upgrades it to a double wedding for himself. Like, it's just, oh, I found another woman with green eyes, I'm gonna marry her too.
I gotta be straight with you, like, the man has been alive for 2200 years and you couldn't find a green-eyed woman. It's like, I understand, like, an East Asian green-eyed woman is rare, but in over 2,000 years, you could literally walk all the way to Europe, to Northern Europe, where there's plenty of women with green eyes. I thought...
Well, Jack asked that, yeah, in the movie.
22 years, he couldn't buy one Aer Lingus ticket? Not one?
2,200 years. Jesus.
So the impression I got is that this is kind of like Ego in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and that he makes a line about like that there were attempts before, but none of them worked.
Like the Kurt Russell connection?
Yeah, one of my assumptions is that in the scene that I really want to get your guys' thoughts on. So as the group is preparing and starting to infiltrate Lopan's headquarters, we see the two brides go through this ceremony that starts out with just a really long kata by Thunder.
Which is awesome.
Just watching. Which is it's really awesome. Impressive. Yeah. But I'm like, so why is this happening? So we get that, but then we get the swords from Rain, right? And then lightning levitates them up to up to the ceiling where they touch that like globe, and
yeah,
and Lopan says something to the effect of, oh, they survived the burning swords and the like pure heart or something like that, so that means they're good. And my assumption is that throughout these 2,000 years he's been bringing girls in there and they've
not been going well
in these parts.
Oh, so assume, yeah, like, he fries them.
It's a body of green-eyed women somewhere.
Yeah, so that's where I assume that somewhere in the basement there's like Guardians of the Galaxy 2. There's just this room with thousands of skulls in it of these women. So now, in light of that, Dom, does that make this seem worse than the sex slavery that we've hand-waved away?
I'd say it's a lateral.
It's a sliding
scale. It's a lateral move. Lateral move.
Yeah, so we get this great scene, and we get the gang infiltrating the headquarters. During that, we get a really fun extra monster in there that we don't get explained really what it is, but this like giant creature bug thing that eats somebody.
Yeah, it does the whole. So it does its best Maury eel imitation, where it comes out, grabs the guy, and pulls him in, and then Egg's like, "You will come out no more." And then they're like, they keep walking, and Jack Burton's like, What just happened? And everyone else is like, no one laments the person that was just just like sit and wait predator grabbed and swallowed up. Everyone's like,
he's a red shirt.
Yeah. No one, likes Steve anyway. Goodbye. Don't come back. No one rescues this guy or anything like that. All right. Nope. Moving on.
Right. And I love, so when they actually get into the, so two things. First, when they first are starting to get out of the caverns and into the actual structure themselves, they see our next really interesting creature. The as a D&D person, I think of this as a beholder, the like floating eye thing. Mm-hmm. That I, when it just shows up, you're like, what the hell is that? And I love that, again, that's where Jack is our voice. He's like, what the hell is that?
The most adorable creature in the movie.
He is kind of cute, right? And they have the little conversation with Lopan through that. That's where we get the whole reason that he's going to marry two, because he can have his cake and eat it too, right? We know that in order to become corporeal or mortal, he has to marry a green-eyed woman and then sacrifice her. So now he can sacrifice one and live out his earthly pleasures on the other one.
And he says it with such an evil cackle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he does.
Which is especially fun if you like close your eyes and hear him say that and think of him as Poe's dad from Kung Fu Panda.
The secret ingredient in my earthly pleasures is green eyes.
Right. Maybe that'll be Kung Fu Panda 4 coming out this year.
There you go.
But they infiltrate the main body of the temple there. We see that really cool. I love that like throne room that the set that they built with like all the statues going down the hallway and like the throne. It's really cool.
And but they have neon lights. Like it looks like it almost like, okay, can we stop? Let's stop. So you have this room that looks straight out of like an ancient thing from Temple of Doom, right? Let's just point it out. Uh-huh. It's got a giant skull with crazy teeth. You have a six-arm monster. Everything's made of carved stone. And I'm like, okay, this looks very old school. But it is trimmed to the nines with neon lights. What happened here? Like, what happened
here? The 80s happened.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I love it.
It follows the other rule that we were talking about a little while ago. Is why did they do this? Because it looks cool.
Metallica skull.
Is cool. Why would he not have a giant neon, you know, like
what I love about this scene where they're infiltrating, to me, this just shows is awesome. A perfect example of Jack's character is that while they're going through, he keeps throwing out like, oh, this is too easy. This is too easy. Like he's so smart and he's recognizing what none of them are. And they're all like, yeah, we know. Like this is you're not revealing anything important here. Mm-hmm. We're like, oh, he's the voice of reason here and he's going to save them from being trapped. But really, he's just wasting their time because they all know. Yeah, no one's here because the wedding's about to happen. So they only care about that. They get to drink from the six demon bag, right?
What is that potion? Is it just like ecstasy? Because they just get real like cozy after that.
I feel like it's just Jack Daniels. It's just it's in a special thing, but I feel like that's the MacGuffin.
That makes sense.
Just the, you know, let's everybody have a drink before you go. It's just a shot of whiskey. Like it's egg, so it's just
Can we talk about that elevator scene? Which is one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
So good.
Where they're on there, so it's good. Like, I feel good. I got a positive attitude. And then that one guy starts rubbing egg on his shoulder. And I'm like, what is happening here? This stuff is so great. Good. Like,
yeah.
It is. It's a magic potion.
Like, if that elevator ride was any longer, this would turn into a weird, weird porno.
It's really true, yeah.
Yeah, true, true. But that takes us to really the climactic scene of this movie, the wedding. And I love, so we get, one of the comments they had was that first the women, the wives are brought down into this, the neon and skulls arena that Dom just described. And that Lopan gets there and glides down. And they were saying that, like, on set, anytime they did that, like, and James Hong got on the escalator, once it would start moving, he would just say, like, to himself, but out loud, here we go, wee! And they're like, we don't even think, like, he was trying to be funny. This is just his own internal dialogue. Like,
that's so great.
So it's just funny to watch that and hear that. And we get the ceremony that Jack has a great entrance to that ceremony and really saves the day, right?
Absolutely. Walks in, he's got the machine gun.
Fires it into the ceiling and knocks himself out.
And immediately knocks himself out and takes
so great.
Yeah, I love it. That's just, a perfect example of his character, the hero. You're like, he's got the gun, he's there, and
Cowboy rolls in the room, fires 8 rounds into the ceiling. Knocks himself
out.
And
then the fighting begins with everyone else.
And then the fight starts in spite of
it. Right. And we get some really cool, like, Wang Chin, again, Dennis Dunn has some incredible fight moves in here. He kind of goes one-on-one with Rain in this really epic sword fight. They do this just amazing flying scene. And, again, Dennis Dunn didn't really have any experience doing filmed martial arts before this. So I'd heard that he spent a lot of time really practicing his sword moves because he really wanted this scene to come out looking good. They said that he would carry like a wooden sword with him all the time off set so that he could practice with it. And I thought it came out great. I thought it looked awesome. All the, like both they're fighting on the ground and then while they're flying in the air, like.
Yeah. Like I said, they really kind of focused on the big kicks, the big punches, the big sword fights, the big thing. The only person that doesn't have a big thing, Jack, who takes a knife out. What does he put it on his shoe and he stabs a guy and the guy falls on him and he gets stuck.
He can't get out.
It's amazing how everything is like the finishing punch and the finishing kick and the slice and the flip and the sword fight in the air. And then there's Jack stuck in like a weird yoga pose with a armored guy on top.
Yeah.
His two big moves are the machine gun that knocks himself out and then getting trapped under it.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. But he does have a showdown with Lopan. He throws a knife at him.
So do you guys think that this is he like sandbagging it? Like, I can't throw a knife. Because it just, falls against a gong and you're like, oh, well, he's just Jack Burtoning it right now. But then he gets really good when he gets the knife back. So is that a plant or is he just get super lucky?
I think it's this. I think it's, you ever hear the expression, a broken clock is right twice a day?
Oh, okay.
That's what I feel. Jack Burton is. I feel like he's got we all have a talent. His talent is he has quick reflexes. It may be his only talent aside from his haircut. So I think that's what happens. He throws the knife, he misses. Then, James Hong picks it up and goes, this is a good knife. And he throws it, and then he does the reflex thing. He catches it, he throws it back. And it's the whole, like, foreshadowing from the beginning of the movie thing. So he ends up being the hero simply because he survives this long, and then by sheer luck, his one talent pays off in the end. That's
right.
It.
Exactly.
That's what happens.
I like that.
I like that.
It's a great. So I like that he does get to be effective one time.
Yeah.
Me and he takes out the bad guy.
That's right.
I found that to be a little anticlimactic. So I feel
it's
like
a little easy.
Yeah. So I feel like the way that John Carpenter like amped it up, he's like, okay, so he just gets stabbed in the head and dies. Let's just have all the Buddhas fall over. All of them just go all over. Yeah.
Well, right. But then it takes us to this great the Great Escape, right? After this, they run out of there, and we get this great scene where Thunder, who we've seen just be a badass throughout the movie, because again, Carter Wong, long experience in martial arts movies, you know, he's been probably the toughest guy in the entire movie, sees them, and he has his dramatic moment where he blows himself up.
He suicide bombs the guys to no effect, but yeah
I like in the, I think it was the commentary with the special effects guy, who I forget who was moderating it from, Shout Factory, asked him like, why did he blow himself up? And Steve was like, you know, I don't think we ever decided that. Like, there's really not a reason in there. I guess the suicide attack is probably a good way to look at it. But he's like, yeah, I don't know. We just thought this would be really cool to have him do this.
And it was.
They're not wrong.
And it was, right? And they escape out of the, they escape out of the sewer. They have one more. Is it? No, Rain got killed during the sword fight, right? So is it Lightning?
He died. So Rain got killed in the sword fight. He landed on a sword and then exploded. Thunder suicide exploded. And then Lightning got a Buddha statue dropped on his head because he's pursuing them up.
I like that one even. Like, super powerful guy, and he gets a statue dropped on his head.
It's bonked on his head.
I mean, there are some major powerful guys that have been killed with giant things falling on their head. For example, the Predator in Predator 1.
That's true.
A log falls on him. A log kills the Predator. So, like, large, heavy objects, I feel like, are the best way to take out super powerful beings. I'm sticking
like
my rep on it.
I like it. Yep. You know, somehow didn't kill the Wet Bandits. They survived a lot of those, but but yeah, they escape, and we get our great moment where everybody's reunited, everybody's saved, and of course Jack is going to get the girl here at the end.
Or is he?
He does. He gets his poor little girl back.
Oh, there you go. Right, his real love, as we've said, is the Pork Chop Express, and he rides it off into the sunset, not with Gracie Law, but with one hidden character. The Wild Man.
I noticed the internet asked a lot, like, what happens afterwards with him and the Wild Man? Like, does he get killed by the, does he die? It's very wide open. I believe there's a comic book series that covers what happens afterwards. And if I remember right, it turns into like a supernatural Bigfoot and the Bear, where they just go on adventures.
That sounds
together,
awesome.
If I remember right, I could. That might just be a hallucination, but I know there was a comic book series.
They become friends? I'm just imagining Kurt Russell and the Wild Man, like, walking through, like, a valley with flowers. Don't you know that you're my best friend?
Now, I see them at, like, a trucker bar in St. Louis, popping buds.
I got a weird vibe, just quickly at the ending, like, they're all in that, they're back at Wing's restaurant, and when, like, Egg leaves and then Kurt Russell leaves, there's, like, this weird, like, They're walking out into this like cloudy mist. I don't know. Like, it almost felt like they were in like some weird limbo or like purgatory in this restaurant, and like leaving it didn't feel good to me. Like, I don't know, maybe just leaving the movie, but there's something going on here. Like the end of Return of the King, where they get on the ship there. Like, it just felt like, I don't know if I feel good about this.
Oh, they're going to
something I needed to
the Jack Burton Valinor.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, I know there was also a comic book. I'm just looking this up. There was a limited series crossover between Jack Burton and Snake Plissken, which I need to read because that's another all-time great.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have
to
check
this out. Got the one-liners. Jeez.
But guys, that's Big Trouble in Little China. I think we have now, we're like minutes away from exceeding the time of this movie. So, Dom, I'm hoping that you could close us out and bring us some science in this movie with tons of science in it.
With science!
Yes, science!
Science!
It's not rocket science! Just say yes and we'll move on!
Science!
I don't think science knows, actually.
Blinded me! With science!
Alright, so one of the themes of this movie was Lopan needs to marry / sacrifice, or both, or whatever, a green-eyed woman. So one of the things I find that people think they understand, but they really don't, is, what is eye color? I mean, seriously, like it's one of those things that you don't realize you're actually interested in. And most people don't realize that they don't know how it works. So let's talk about that. So the question today is, how do you get green eyes? First things first, green eyes are the rarest eye color outside of gray. So all the other eye colors aside from gray are more common than green. So, and it's the most common in Northern Europe. So, that's why I was like, Lopan, you should have been hanging out in like Denmark, dude, for the past 2000 years. You would have had a much, much higher likelihood of becoming a person again. So anyway, first of all, eye color is the color of the iris, okay, which is the muscular part that can dilate and constrict to let light in or out.
It's also my favorite Goo Goo Dolls song.
Western New York. Hey, we're a stereotype. All right, Eric, moving on. So there are actually two major things that contribute to eye color. The first is pigmentation. Now, mammals, us, do not produce crazy colors of pigmentation. We only really produce a few types. The major one is melanin. That's what gives our skin the dark versus light color. And melanin is what also we deposit in our iris. Most humans have a lot of melanin in our iris, which is the reason why most humans have brown eyes. Okay, because brown eyes are the color of brown melanin. In fact, 80% of humans on Earth are brown-eyed. Right, it could be a lighter or darker brown, but it's a brown-eyed. Caucasian people don't really realize this because most people with non-brown eyes are of Caucasian descent. But if you go outside in the world, most people have brown eyes. All right, and which is simply just a lot of melanin. All right, so first things first, in order for you to have green eyes, you need to have less melanin deposited in your iris. But in addition, you need another pigment deposited called lipochrome. So the lipochrome looks a little yellow, and less melanin and more lipochrome makes your eyes look amber. And amber eyes, which is basically a yellowish kind of like brown, is one thing you need to have, right? The second factor is not a pigment at all. It's something called structural color, which is where you need your eye to refract light in such a way to create a color. So here's an interesting thing. Our eyes refract light similar to the way that the atmosphere does. So the effect that you get in order to get a blue sky is the same effect you have to get blue eyes. It's the same thing. So what makes the sky blue and what makes your eyes blue is the refraction, is the scattering of light. So what happens is with people with blue eyes is they have very little pigment in their eyes and something called a turbid media, which is found in your iris, causes light to refract in such a way that it looks blue. And the reason that is because blue is a short wavelength and particles in your eye refract that light so blue reflects out, which is the same thing that happens in the atmosphere. Particles in the atmosphere refract light and it appears blue. So what happens is if you have blue eyes, light is being refracted and the pigment isn't obscuring it. So in order to have green eyes, you need to have the lipochrome, not a lot of melanin, and the turbid media to refract the light. So now that's how you get green eyes. Amber plus blue equals green. And that's how you get green eyes, right? And that combination is super rare, which is why green eyes are super rare. Having one, blue, more common. Having it dark, brown, super common. But both, you know, but having like that amber and blue is very uncommon. And another thing, which I'm just going to talk about really quickly, everyone thinks that eye color is determined by one gene. Oh, I got eye color from my mom. I got eye color from my dad. They think it's 16 genes. So it's a very, very complicated thing, right? Yeah. So
I always thought it was just one gene.
No, so they found that it's two major genes that they know about and potentially 14 others that they're still trying to work out. So it's not what
it's not gene summons.
No, it's not gene summons. So it's not Stonewashed genes. It's not
the rules official from the NFL.
Oh, it's Judo Gene. Judo Gene. That's
Judo Gene LaBelle. Yeah, Judo Gene LaBelle chooses our eye color.
That is now a Punches and Popcorn fact.
That's the way it should work.
And that's all I got. That's how green eyes are made. So it's light refraction and amber colored eyes combined together.
Oh, fascinating. Another great, wonderful science segment. Thank you, Dr. Dom. All right, guys.
Thanks,
so
Tom.
Before we close this out, you know, one of the things we like to highlight because we are all huge fans here is physical media and genius, Jay Burton Bills. What would you say, Matt? And I know you're a big physical media guy, too. What do you think? So feel free to weigh in here. What do you think is the definitive physical release of this movie that our listeners should be tracking down if they do not have already?
I'll let Matt take this. He's a esteemed guest.
I think Shout Factory just put one out.
Yeah.
A year or two ago. It's probably 5 years now because I have no concept of time anymore.
Well, they released it on 4K, so it was Blu-ray was the big collector's edition.
That's what it was.
Now they have the 4K. Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say go with the Shout Factory 4K because it's a really nice transfer. It's got all the commentaries that Mike was talking about.
Yeah, three different commentaries.
Yeah, it's nice too because they sometimes a lot of times with a new reissue of a, you know, a physical media, they just have new stuff on it, but they collected most of the stuff from the past, like from the big DVD that came out in like the early 2000s. Like, so it does a nice job of like a compilation of all the extra features. So it's definitely the one to get.
Yeah. I would say, you know, if you can't get your hands on it, just make sure you find one copy that has the commentary track with Kurt Russell and John Carpenter, because I think that is the definitive commentary for me. I think that's my favorite out of any DVD
right
commentary I've listened
yeah.
to. But that one and the one from the original Ghostbusters, where it's the Mystery Science Theaterum. So there's the overlay of the three heads down at the bottom, and it's I want to say it's Ramis Aykroyd and Ivan Reitman, if I remember right.
Oh,
but
I got
that's neither here nor there.
Yes.
I highly, highly recommend Big Trouble in Little China's 4K from Shout Factory or any of them that have the original, like Jay said, the early 2000s DVD release.
That's when studios would put money into special features. Like they're tricked out. Yeah.
Cool menus on that one, if I remember right, too, which is a lost art. But yeah, it's worth it just to hear Carpenter and Kurt Russell talk for 15 minutes about how their kids are doing.
Yeah,
right. Which is wild because one of the kids that they talk about is Wyatt Russell. They ask like when the moccasins come up, you know, Kurt mentions like, oh yeah, we were just in Aspen and walked by the store that apparently he got these from, and they had him make a pair for Wyatt. And then later they talk about Wyatt in doing I can't remember what it is, like football or hockey or some sport, right? They're just talking about Wyatt, who's had to be real, like he's a kid at the time, like a teenager or something, and now
he's maybe 12 or 16.
Right, and now he's Wyatt Russell from Overlord and Black Mirror and Falcon and Winter Soldier. So it's fun to know like
Monarch
that's the kid they're talking about. Oh right, he's in that too. Like he's like the perfect distillation of Kurt Russell and Melanie Griffith, which is a ridiculous pairing, right?
Goldie
Hawn. Oh, Melanie Griffith.
Melanie Griffith.
Wow, yes, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of.
Sorry, we bet you're wrong.
Creating Hollywood scandals.
Yeah. Oh my God. You're starting some rumors here. Kurt's got some.
No, Goldie Hawn. Oh boy. Well, this is why
spilling
I have
the tea at the end of this thing.
But yeah, I have this disc. It's great. The second disc has like over a dozen interviews with everybody involved. Like. On the screen and behind the screen, and they're all great. So highly recommend.
I recommend the ones on the screen more than the ones behind because that's tough to see.
Right.
Just being a jerk.
Well, this is fun. Matt, thank you for joining us again. Hope that we'll have you on more of these as we venture through the 80s in this season, Once Upon a Time in the 80s.
I hope so, too. I hope I haven't been too annoying.
No,
it's been fun.
No, you've been wonderful. Again, your seat is open anytime you want.
Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Yes. All right. So to all our listeners, want to thank you again for joining us in another Once Upon a Time in the 80s adventure. Give us a follow on Twitter or X, Instagram, Threads, and TikTok. All of those are at Punches and Popcorn. If you're looking for more 80s action, make sure you give us a follow or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or any of your other favorite podcast apps. And be sure to check out all our other shows on the Lunch Hour Podcast Network. Matt, do you just want to give us a quick preview of what other great stuff is out there in Lunchador for our listeners to listen to?
Got Behind the Glass, which covers some fantastic local artists here in Rochester, New York. We've got Food About Town and Refined Taste that are talking about local restaurants here in Rochester and Buffalo, the Western New York Finger Lakes area. Paulie Guglielmo show is going to be with us. He kind of covers a lot of food stuff, also into entrepreneurial, kind of how to build your business stuff.
Awesome.
It's a great show. Anomaly, if you want more movie talk. Level Up podcast, if you want to hear about coffee stuff. Oh, yeah. I've learned more about coffee listening to Weigh It and Level Up.
I love that one.
I never knew before.
Yeah.
So a lot of good stuff coming and a lot of new stuff coming too. So it's we're starting with 10 or 11 shows. Behind the Studio Door with Molly O'Reilly talking about the intersection of culture and politics, I think.
Ooh,
it's
nice.
Really interesting. The Our Voices project with our buddy Jackie McGriff.
Oh yes,
beautiful.
It's gonna be great. We like to tease things here. Yeah. We were talking about where the penthouse thing. We never got back to that, so we'll just put a pin in that too.
Oh, that's true. That's and
it's okay. It's for next time.
Right.
I think our audience should incognito Google that.
There you go. A little treat we'll leave you with this week if you're so inclined.
The choice is in your hands. And if you did enjoy this discussion of Big Gross. Trouble in Little China, our friends at the Anomaly Podcast, led by Matt here, did cover that recently. So go check out their episode 2 and get more Jack Burton and get just a flavor for the fun stuff that I love the discussion you guys have on Anomaly. Looking
Me
forward
too.
To us hopefully partnering on some more fun stuff.
Highlander.
This season,
we're just so. Talking about it last night. Looking forward to
yes,
it.
Yes, absolutely. So check those out. Thank you again. Thanks, guys, for joining us on the Pork Chop Express. Thank you all for listening. And until next time, just remember.
When some wild-eyed, 8-foot tall maniac grabs your neck, taps the back of your favorite head up against a barroom wall, and he looks you crooked in the eye, and he asks you if you've paid your dues, well, you just stare that big sucker right back in the eye, and you remember what old Jack Burton always says at a time like that. Have you paid your dues, Jack? Yes, sir, the check is in the mail.
Good night.
It's all in the reflexes.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.